Hey listeners, Dennis Wisco here. I wanted to tell you about a conference, or rather a summit, that Wisco Weekly will be covering from June 18th until the 20th in Marina Del Rey, California at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. Thought Leadership Summits is hosting their two big annual summits. I came across these summits last year and have been following them ever since. They fuse together the best thought leaders in automotive and technology. The goal of these summits is to optimize the customer experience. And that's why Wisco Weekly is proud to partner with Thought Leadership Summits. Because if you've ever listened to our show, we are constantly seeking the best companies and individuals who are delivering an excellent customer experience in automobility and advanced transportation. Listeners of the show can get 20% off tickets, and they have a variety of tickets. You can attend a single summit, or you can get their summit series, or you can even just attend a breakout session. This offer won't last long and expires at the end of day on June 7th. To register, visit tlsummits.com and enter the code WISCO20 at checkout. That's tlsummits.com. and WISCO20 at checkout. And if by chance you aren't able to attend, then be sure you follow Wisco Weekly on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and LinkedIn to see what happened at this summit series. Previously on Wisco Weekly.
So I'm not exactly paying my fair share for the wear and tear that I put in on our roads. Now, I obviously the benefit to the environment and all of that. But so when you start thinking about use fees for the 21st century, a lot of discussion is, hey, pay for what you use. So you can pay for what you use, maybe by mileage.
And on this episode,
I think we have to be flexible about our future, because right now, as far as transportation goes, it's really uncertain. Where are we going to be going with autonomous vehicle technology? What's going to happen with connected, electric, shared vehicles? I don't know. We're all learning kind of as we go, but giving away right of way to implement, you know, to put in rail in the ground to move a few people compared to what we really need to move, I think is unwise.
This is Wisco Weekly, an automobility and advanced transportation podcast where we feature the voices and issues that are shaping the way we travel and commute.
Tune in to the Wisco Weekly Experience.
Chicken brown cow. Listeners, hello again. Welcome to another episode of Wisco Weekly. To all you listeners out there, thank you for your ears. You are tuned in to Wisco Weekly, and we're giving you the business. We're giving you the new society and culture of automobility and advanced transportation. Before we get to today's guest, let's get into some automotive news. Nissan Motor Company, in their quest to develop self-driving cars, is taking a page out of Elon Musk's playbook of avoiding LiDAR technology to sense and map a 3D area around a car. LiDAR is a technology that has garnered billions of dollars in investments, and its current limitation is the high cost associated with manufacturing it. Automakers who are betting on LiDAR technology include Ford, GM, and Google's Waymo. However, with the surge in Teslas hitting the streets over the last 1.5 years, if there's any chance for LiDAR technology to win over automakers and consumers alike, I'm going to say that the technology may just have to outlive the Iron Man himself. In other news, U.S. DOT's Federal Transit Administration is making available $423 million for funding bus service to eligible recipients. Projects eligible for this funding opportunity include those that would replace, rehabilitate, lease, or purchase buses and related equipment. I can only hope that with these funds, transportation agencies take heed of the advice of a previous guest on this show, Mr. Jonathan English. According to Jonathan's doctoral research, the six pillars of successful transit include frequency, connectivity, speed, coverage, span, and fair fares. have a listen to episode number 74 to hear greater insights and details into these pillars. Also, some upcoming announcements here. WSCO Weekly is going to be at a few different events. There's the Thought Leadership Summit coming up in June, TechCrunch in July, and Digital Dealer in August. And now let's get to this week's show. Today's guest is, in short, a rising star. She's very outspoken when it comes to what would be deemed overreach and overspending of government agencies. Littered throughout the Washington Policy Center website, you can find her articles on transportation issues and policies. What's more, she partook in the pilot of Washington State's Road User Charge Project. In this pilot, her driving activity was tracked as a means to test the waters of a mileage tax. The more you drive, the more you have to pay to the state to fund infrastructure and transit projects. Washington is one of the very few states to pilot this program to understand its potential and application in today's mobility society. Currently, she leads the Coles Center for Transportation for the Washington Policy Center. Their mission is to research and analyze best practices for relieving traffic congestion with a specific focus on highway and transit projects and how tax dollars are spent. What I find to be of most interest is the journey of my guest to her current role. She was born in Russia, emigrated to the U.S. as a child, and performed missionary work in the Dominican Republic, Spain, and Northern Africa. What parts or how much of this upbringing has influenced her advocacy on efficient travel and policymaking? We'll find out. She is a proud Husky from the University of Washington. Men, women, and children, please welcome to the show the charming, the opinionated, and the intelligent director of the Coles Center for Transportation, Mrs. Maria Frost.
Hi, Dennis. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Of course, Maria. Thank you for being on. Sincerely appreciate it, especially since you were up in Washington. How's the weather up there right now?
It's raining, which I welcome because we've had some heat the last couple weeks that, as you know, we are not used to here.
Oh, I would love to trade places with you. Down here in Southern California, it was raining, a little cloudy. And especially me, I'm an islander. I love the sun. I need the sun. I need that vitamin D. Anyhow, so Maria, one of the things actually before we get going is I know you're active on social media. I love your Twitter. I love your Facebook. But how can you, do you want to share your handle so people can follow you?
Sure. So you can look me up on Facebook at Maria Frost, M-A-R-I-Y-A, Frost, as in Jack Frost, and the same on Twitter.
And the same on Twitter. And listeners, I will put on the episode notes her handles there. By the way, for your name Maria and the spelling of it, would you also go by Masha? Masha?
Masha? Yes. Yeah, it's kind of the way I describe it to folks here, you know, in Russia, Maria and Masha are synonymous. Hmm. Maria is a more formal way of saying my name. Masha is what my close friends and family call me. My brother calls me Mosh.
Okay.
My mother does call me by my formal first name and middle name when she's frustrated with me.
Which is?
And that's Maria Alexandrovna.
Alexandrovna,
Which sounds better in Russian. It's Maria Alexandrovna.
Mm. Very nice. Well, your husband will have to actually pick up on that too so that he can have that same kind of intonation and condescending tone with you.
Yes, yes.
Well, so Maria, one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on this show specifically was because of what you do with the Washington Policy Center and essentially your background and how you got there. So hopefully throughout the nature of this conversation, we'll kind of start to see your journey to where you are today and essentially the things that you're doing, how it's shaping policies and culture in the state of Washington and then potentially here in California as well. One of the things that I know that you participated in was the pilot project for the road user charge program in the state of Washington. So I was hoping to start things off. You could first define, so that we are using the same language, what is a road user charge? And then if you can maybe just share your thoughts about, you know, is this, you know, essentially what is your position on a road user charge?
Sure. So here we call it a road usage charge. It's also known more generally throughout the nation as mileage-based user fees, or MBUFs. And what it is a replacement, or the state and national effort to replace the fuel tax that we pay per gallon at the pump with a method whereby we pay for every mile that we drive instead, which is seen as a more fair way to pay for transportation. And in general, our viewpoint on the road usage charge is, at least in Washington state, we see a lot of strong political interests that really seek to harness that money and use it for other things that are not related to highways that would not benefit the drivers who are paying the road usage charge. And I think that really, well, I don't think that strips it of its user fee designation and makes it a mileage tax. And so right now we just completed our pilot. The pilot is an isolated experiment, which I'm happy to talk about my experience with that. I think there's a big difference, a chasm really, between the pilot and what would be the policy after this idea moves through the messy political process here in Washington state. And we have a lot of concerns about that.
So it is a foregone conclusion then that it sounds like the state of Washington is in favor of something like this. And then B, it's just a matter then of diving into the details of how this will actually work. Is that a fair assessment to say?
This issue has not come before our legislature, so I don't know that I can say whether the state is for or against it. I would say the public is very, very concerned because this is a dramatic shift in how we pay for transportation. It includes a massive privacy trade-off that folks would be having, you know, to make, you know, the kinks of which have not all been fully worked out. So I wouldn't say that this is something that people necessarily support. It is something that lawmakers and transportation folks are looking at as a potential replacement for the gas tax. I, of course, think the gas tax has a lot of life left, and there's a lot that we can do with the gas tax, including asking for reasonable voter-approved increases, and then implementing something different, a type of user fee in the future when it's more appropriate, and when it would, in fact, be a user fee. So to answer your question, no, I don't know that there's widespread support. It is something that's being considered and still has to be debated. We're hoping to see this issue come before the legislature next year, reports and so on and so forth, and further debate. And obviously, we're going to, you know, be a part of that and include our voice in that debate.
Okay, well, so let's actually start to discuss a little bit more the particulars of the road usage charge, that pilot project that you are part of. So maybe first off, let's start with when you signed up for this. This was then a matter of you implementing some sort of device to which would track your miles. So let's start from there. Tell me, what was the device that you used that was tracking your miles?
To begin, I want to say that we had roughly four options for submitting mileage. The GPS transponder is not the only option, but as I will explain, I think it's the option that people will be cornered into.
Why is that?
Well, so let me explain to you the different methods of mileage collection that are being offered in the pilot. So one of them is a mileage permit where you prepay for the number of miles that you wish to drive, and then the state gives you a sticker or some sort of somewhere where you can indicate, this is the number of miles that I've been authorized to drive. Not a very popular method. just on principle, but also because, you know, it does not distinguish between the miles that you drive in state versus the miles that you drive out of state. It's just you're prepaying for miles. So if 200 of those miles are outside of the state, you still pay for them. Another method is the odometer reading, and that's where you snap a picture of your odometer and you submit that through a smartphone app to a third-party provider like DriveSync, which is the app that I used. And that method is the less invasive of the of all the options, but it too does not account for the miles that you drive out of state. So you end up overpaying there as well. And that's why I say that the GPS transponder option is probably the one that people will be kind of cornered into choosing, because that option is you know, a device that you install in your vehicle that tracks your mileage. And because it knows your location, it is able to distinguish between the miles that you drive in and out of state. And so you're only charged for the miles that you drive in the state. And it prevents that overcharging. But of course, on the trade-off that you are, you know, relinquishing some of your privacy, you're waiving some of those rights to the privacy that you would normally expect. So that in the pilot, I tested for half the pilot, I tested the GPS transponder, and then the other half of the pilot, I tested the odometer reading, and I'm happy to talk about either one of those.
And how long was the pilot that you were part? Well, how long was the pilot, and how long were you a part of it?
The pilot was about 1 year. I think they got a slightly less start, so I think it came out to, you know, a little under a year.
And how many miles did you log total?
So that's an interesting question to ask, because I was on maternity leave for a few months, and okay. So there were not a lot of miles to log during that time.
But still, I mean, these are going to be situations people are going to have to, that people will be faced with. I mean, not everyone obviously is going to be driving around. Some people might have to be on maternity leave. Some people may be working from home.
No. So when I installed the device, I had to sync it with my app, and that's it. I mean, it's pretty mindless. After my first drive, I received an alert on my app. And this was the very surprising part. I had completed a trip, and I opened the app, and I found out that I was graded on that trip. So I was graded based on my acceleration, speed, cornering, and braking. And this was very surprising to me. I understood that when I was participating in this pilot, you know, in the name of research, I gave up my personal information. I knew that my mileage would be collected, but I was not aware that I would be graded, which the Washington State Transportation Commission called that value-added feature of the app.
Of it was?
I mean, I would not call it value-added. I was shocked. And, you know, I was receiving pretty poor grades. And I think I'm a pretty decent driver. You know, you make some judgment calls on the road when you speed up, you know, to go 65. Our speed limit here is 60 on highways. And, you know, you make judgment calls to speed up to pass, you know, semis and things like that. And what I found in the app is I could click on every single infraction, and it showed me a satellite view of my trip. And it showed the point at which I started speeding or whatever I was doing. And that would tell me you went 65 miles per hour for 13 seconds from this point to this point. It was extremely detailed. And then you could see along your entire trip these various points where you committed these infractions or what would be considered infractions in our state. And I was very surprised and unsettled by that. I didn't feel like that was a value added or something that I expected or signed up for.
You know, this kind of reminds me where there was a previous guest on the show. His name was Brian Biniak, who's a founder of a company called Connected Travel, which they basically do this for the private market, though, right? For specifically Honda in this case, where in the car, there's not a transponder, but it's built into the system already, built into a Honda car, where they are tracking this information, and it is supposed to be a value add, but it's also the value add is it's creating these incentives, or you build these points which are redeemable at a whatever local retail store, a Starbucks, a Pete's Coffee, fast food store, whatever the case may be. Is there an opportunity for that kind of incentive model through this quote unquote value add?
I think that's a good question. I mean, the trade-off that I'm used to making with regard to privacy really has to do with things like social media or my phone, right? People always bring up those examples of, well, we've already given away our privacy. What's the big deal?
Yeah.
And just adding another device to your car, your phone already has GPS on it. But my phone is, you know, a voluntary thing. I make voluntary transactions with T-Mobile, who I've contracted with. I could choose to discontinue that contract. I could choose to turn off my phone without that being a crime.
Right. And so, like, in this case, is because it's a tax inherently, then yes. there's no way to avoid this. This is the government knocking on your door, guns blazing, saying, hey, you better pay this.
Sure. And I have a hard time believing that government, once they've imposed a certain rate or tax, would provide incentives or ways for them to reduce the tax burden on the public. Generally speaking, the tax burden goes up as government seeks more and more revenue. So to answer your question, I don't know, but that scenario with incentives seems very unlikely with a system that is operated by the state. And another point I wanted to mention is I asked about this from the State Transportation Commission, which is leading this pilot project, and they said, well, there would possibly be a white label government option for those folks who don't want the value added features that this provides. In other words, your two options here are to use the private sector, but then be graded on your drives, or go through the state government, not be graded on your drive, but you're submitting your private information to state government.
You know, perhaps a more philosophical question, though, for you, Maria, is you serve as the director of the Cole Center for Transportation. And so on one hand, if road usage is an opportunity for users to play fair or to, you know, use the roads and pay for the roads that they're using, if the system by which it tracks individuals is not quite sufficient, is there such a middle ground with you that a road usage charge could be implemented?
So I want to start by saying that people do pay for the roads that they use. We in Washington State pay, I think, the third highest gas tax in the nation. That could quickly become, you know, the first in no time. You know, we came very close to increasing the gas tax almost 19 cents per gallon this year through a combination of a 6-cent gas tax increase and a 13-cent per gallon carbon tax. And so I think that's the direction the state is headed in. Going back to your question on paying for roads with a road usage charge, I think in the future, as we truly have more fuel-efficient vehicles on our roads, sure, this could definitely be an option. I think it's a very, very long way off.
Oh, really?
Both practically and politically. And the reason I say that is, number one, I think the gas tax has a lot of life left. We like the gas tax. It's cheap. It's easy to collect from the public. It's fair. And so with a road usage charge, we're looking at an entirely new system that requires a new bureaucracy to impose it. And we're looking at redesigning the framework and making sure that the money that's collected in a road usage charge is protected for highway purposes only, which in and of itself is going to be a political battle. The gas tax in Washington State is protected by the 18th Amendment, our state 18th Amendment in the Constitution, and it's protected for highway purposes only. And a lot of folks would like to replace that with a revenue source that is more open, that can go into a general pot of transportation money for redistribution to what public officials believe is best.
Was at the conclusion of the pilot, did you have to submit your own thoughts on the matter, or was it just they just wanted to track your activity? They didn't want to gauge, you know, how you felt about the project or any insight.
So we received kind of simulated invoices for you know what we would be charged in miles tax.
So that was
part of it. You receive an invoice that
shows weekly or daily or monthly?
It was either monthly or quarterly.
Okay.
And so we receive these simulated invoices that show how many miles you drove and what you know what that equates to. We were charged 2.4 cents per mile, which is equivalent to the 49.4 cents per gallon that we pay. And then it showed this is how much you paid in fuel tax, theoretically. And then there's a credit on the invoice for the miles that you paid in gas tax. And so then the remaining balance is the road usage charge. So for people who drive more fuel efficient vehicles, there is a larger amount left over to pay, a larger balance. For people who drive, you know, trucks and less fuel efficient vehicles, I think some of them may have even gotten money back in theory on the invoice. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting element we can talk about later. There was that. There were also surveys that we were given periodically, not many. I think there were three where we were asked for our feedback, which I really appreciated and provided. And, you know, the surveys were fine, but I mean, it's an isolated pilot project. The rate is flat. There's no administrative fee like you would experience in a real program. There's no politics involved. There's no, you know, discussion about where the revenue would be distributed to, right? Which is a very intense debate. And so by, you know, there was no way that the pilot would not be successful. You know what I mean?
I see. Yeah, totally. I mean, yeah, it's like the concept and the execution of the concept was great, but once you start to add in all the layers of public buy-in, that's when it just starts to get yucky and mucky, and who knows what'll end up happening at that point. So
exactly. Well, and it felt like, you know, government just kind of jumping through the hoop, because this pilot is not something new. It's actually been done in our state before at a smaller level. In participation, I think it was like a USDOT pilot, so it had fewer participants in it. So to me, it wasn't so much about testing the technical feasibility of this type of, you know, collection of transportation dollars, but it was more about testing the public feasibility. Can we get this through the public? Can
exactly.
we get people on board with this? And can we, you know, and that's what they showed in the survey, that the amount of how people felt at the beginning of the pilot changed, you know, with how they felt at the end. They were like, oh yeah, this might be okay. And I mean, to me, that seems to be the real objective, is to say, hey, this is really simple. This is really easy. It's not, you know, a huge breach of privacy. It's not going to be a big deal, just a simple replacement. But it's not that simple, and it's a lot more complicated. And to say that the pilot is an accurate representation of what we'd see if this was enacted as a policy, I think is inaccurate and dishonest. And that's what we've been saying at the Washington Policy Center.
Well, and further to that, so this kind of gets back to one of the points then about a few minutes ago, was that the manner in which this revenue could be used could be very controversial, where if the user is using highways and streets, well, that's where the benefit should go, or that's where the funds should go. I remember when New York was having this discussion, and Mayor de Blasio was constantly saying, no road usage charge, no road usage charge, but we need to fund our subway and our public transportation system. And then all of a sudden, one day he flipped, and he was all about the road usage charge, about funding the public transportation system. So this is kind of then where you would see where it does start to get a bit volatile, when you do have these funds that could be administered not just to highways, but to transit projects that aren't really serving the user at that point.
Right, that's exactly it. I mean, we support direct user fees. And we, in Washington State, transit is not underfunded. We just passed in the Puget Sound voters just passed, the largest, what was the largest per capita rail-centric tax package in the nation in 2016. So LA had Measure M, which was about $120 billion. We had Sound Transit 3, which was $54 billion. But on a per capita level for our region and the density of our region, it was really enormous and had a very high cost for a very low benefit in expanding light capacity rail, which was really remarkable that people got behind that, because we're expecting, you know, our region is growing. I mean, it's flourishing, and we're expecting a million people in the Puget Sound, and this system that's $54 billion, and it'll actually be close to $100 billion when you add in the Sound Transit 1 and Sound Transit 2, $54 billion to add 63,000 maybe new users, not transit transfers, but new users to the system. What are we going to do with the other, you know, million people that are coming to the region? How are we going to serve them? How are we going to support a system that moves people the way they want to move, the way they want to live and travel? And so it was really shocking. But all of that to say, transit is not underfunded in our state and does not need more money. In fact, we would support seeing less diversion of the taxes and fees that drivers pay that funds our multimodal account here. We need more money for preservation and maintenance, for capacity expansion, and making and reducing traffic congestion in our state, which our DOT is doing virtually nothing about.
To play devil's advocate, they would argue, right, that these light rail projects, while it may not have an immediate benefit in year one or year two, in year 10 or 20, it will have that benefit of decongesting traffic. So if you do look at what you and the Washington Policy Center are doing to influence how companies and how people and how policy is dictated to reduce traffic congestion, what is it that you guys are doing?
Well, sure. And so what I want to begin by saying is light rail and transit in general does not reduce congestion. That's not the purpose that it serves. Sound Transit itself has said that this project will not reduce congestion. It only provides an alternative to congestion.
Right, yeah.
And so I want to make that clear. What we support in our state is not congestion management, which is the initiative of our state DOT. Congestion management, it means, you know, encouraging or coercing people to take transit by making our roads increasingly more unbearable to use, and then also imposing very unpopular and expensive tolls, which is also unfair to the general public, especially those folks who have no other choices, who have to travel the same road at the same time every day and can't afford to pay, you know, $20 a day on tolls. But going back to your question, that's congestion management. And what we support is congestion reduction. And so what that means is supporting things like van pools, which really pay for themselves. It means supporting strategic capacity additions, adding lanes where there are bottlenecks. And DOT actually did add capacity on I-405, just like a 1 mile stretch. They opened the shoulder during a certain peak hour of travel in the evening, and more people were able to use that stretch mm-hmm. of road per hour. So we moved more people and we moved them faster. And that was just a 1 mile opening of a shoulder for 4 hours or 5 hours,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
right? I mean, imagine what we could do if we strategically added capacity in all of those places. Yes, it would cost a lot of money. Right of way is expensive, but we are serving far more people than we would be with light rail or other such systems. And so I think we need to be more confident and more bold in talking about capacity, in talking about serving current demand, not latent demand or demand that's somewhere, but current demand, people that are having to take arterials or adjust schedules. But there's a whole group of folks who really can't do any of that and are really suffering, and we must accommodate those people with the public dollars that they pay.
Why do you think that the topic of current demand is not as sticky as, let's say, a light rail topic, right? Like, it seems to me that if you were to campaign in the state of Washington to say, hey, we can fix congestion problems by focusing on what the current demand is, so here's what the policy would look like. Wouldn't be almost sexy enough as if to introduce a light rail project.
Well, that's because light rail, I think, is very tangible, right? It's something that people can picture. We see it in movies. We saw it in Black Panther. We saw a train and, you know, this 19th century system in Black Panther, which they're supposed to be super advanced.
So what I hear is that I need to do my part since I'm closer to Hollywood. I need somehow Hollywood to adopt current demand principles, and therefore, once it becomes more pop culture.
Sure. I mean, I do think that the solution to traffic congestion is not a silver bullet, right? I think it's a number of different things. It's a lot of experimentation and seeing what works and what doesn't. And I think politicians are not necessarily attracted to that. I think they need something that they can really grasp and campaign on, something that's really easy and simple to digest. And the real traffic solutions, things like, you know, signal timing and prioritization and are things that we really don't see. There are changes and improvements that we don't see as a public, but they do make a difference. And they make a difference not just for drivers. They make a difference for freight, which we all depend on every day. They make a difference for emergency responders and buses. And so, you know, those are the type of improvements that we support. And also, I think we have to be flexible about our future, because right now, as far as transportation goes, it's really uncertain. Where are we going to be going with autonomous vehicle technology? What's going to happen with connected electric shared vehicles? I don't know. We're all learning kind of as we go, but giving away right of way to implement, you know, to put in rail in the ground to move a few people compared to what we really need to move, I think is unwise, right? I mean, so to speak, it's taking a fixed approach to what is an unfixed future. Well, and we want to remain open to that.
Like, you were both familiar with Mr. Randu O'Toole, and, you know, I'm currently reading his book right now, Gridlock, which this was a book that he wrote back in, you know, 10 years ago. And this was the first time that I have heard about cities describing what they're doing as, be it smart growth or efficiency. And let me kind of read you just a quote from that book. Smart growth advocates say that increased spending on rail transit projects and intercity rail will provide an economic stimulus to help the nation recover. Again, this is back in 2009. Efficiency advocates say that now more than ever, the nation needs to invest its limited resources wisely to improve productivity and minimize waste. So obviously, I would say that you side more with the latter. But if we were to look at what's going on in the state of Washington, again, knowing the fact that he wrote this book 10 years ago, would you say that right now Washington is looking more at, you know, how have they gone along smart growth or perhaps even efficiency?
I think our public officials in the Puget Sound have done a lot of damage to our infrastructure. Not only have they not allowed our supply of roads to keep up with demand, but they have actually reduced our supply of roads as demand has increased. So they have spent billions of dollars to reduce lane capacity. So we have Highway 99 here. They replaced that with a tunnel that they went from 6 to 4 lanes. And this is a road that goes through downtown Seattle. That's always congested. It runs parallel to I-5. So that has been reduced in capacity to make way for a waterfront project that they would like to have. On I-90, which is a major freight corridor, getting you know, goods to the port of Seattle and Tacoma, they have given away a couple lanes on that bridge to Sound Transit so that they could put light rail across the bridge to get light rail from Seattle to Bellevue. And that was also a reduction in capacity, a 20% reduction. So these are decisions that these are policy choices, right? I mean, there's very much a lot of conversation about how, you know, traffic congestion is just kind of happening to us. But it's not just kind of happening to us. It's a series of policy choices that public officials make. And you know, we need to make sure that we're holding them responsible and accountable to those choices. So where we have also seen smart growth in action is at the Washington State Department of Transportation, where our secretary is the former VP of Smart Growth America. And he's all about increasing funding for transit. He said recently that traffic congestion is a problem that we simply can't solve, we can't fix, which is a very troubling statement from our state DOT.
Why do you think he said that? Like, yeah, that seems asinine to me that a public policy official would say that traffic congestion is not something that can be fixed.
I mean, that's a great question. It's a reflection of his beliefs. It's a reflection of a lot of folks who are on the smart growth end of things, who believe that we have built out our highway system as much as possible, and now we just need to focus on expanding transit ridership. And what troubles me about that is the end goal is always increasing transit ridership. And I think it's important that we not be about mode, right? Not be about, everything must end in increased transit ridership, being pro-transit or pro-car. I think we really need to be pro-movement. And what I mean when I say we need to be pro-movement is that we need to look at how the public actually moves. And we need to respond to that, not try to socially engineer the public a certain way. People do have limits, and people will do what they want and what they believe is best for their lives. They will move if they have to. I think to coerce them or to try to coerce them into a certain mode by spending more and more and more money on that mode produces underperforming systems. It's not a wise approach. I want to, you know, you quoted Randall, who I, you know, really, really respect and enjoy. And he was on my road usage charge panel that we'll talk about later at a recent event that we had. But a book that I'm reading now is called Order Without Design by Alan Bertode. And he talks about smart growth as well. And he really believes that we need to induce economics into urban planning, real economics. And he says, advocates of smart growth imply that the reduction of congestion and pollution is the main objective of urban planning. They soon realize that nothing will reduce congestion and pollution more certainly than a decrease in mobility. Reducing mobility is then considered a desirable outcome and is the logical consequence of the confusion between objectives and constraints. For this reason, planners design urban village spatial arrangements which implicitly reduce mobility. And that's what I'm seeing here in the Puget Sound. That's what I mean when I talk about the reduction of capacity on Highway 99 or I-90, the lack of additional capacity anywhere in the Puget Sound really speaks to this effort to densify our region and try to move people into a certain way of life. And that's, gosh, I don't see that being successful anytime soon, especially with housing prices.
Well, Maria, you carry a certain level of empathy and vigor towards this topic, but in general, your beliefs. In the introduction, I had mentioned that your upbringing is very unique, and maybe this is a good time to talk a little bit about that then now. So, I mean, how is it that you came to be so, for instance, so pro individual mobility?
Sure. You know, I think that was a process. I probably didn't appreciate it so much when I was little. So my family and I immigrated from Russia. And, you know, my parents had a different experience than I did. I came here when I was 5. And so they had a deeper and more long-lasting experience with communism than I did. And even living in a communist country, I don't think I experienced it the way that they did, because they did such a great job just keeping me happy and letting me be a child, regardless of our environment. I mean, when we came to the United States, we were very poor. My parents were both educated. My father has a master's degree in art. You know, now he owns a gallery here in Washington State. My mother was a dentist in Russia, and now she is a nurse in a hospital here in Washington State. They're both very, very successful people, but it was a long process for them. And
was there any moment of, you know, and maybe now we're talking about when you are living in America now, but was there any moment for you where you were a part of something, or you heard something and you just intrinsically felt like, you know what, no, that's not right. We should have the ability to make our own decisions. We should have these choices. Is there any turning point with you on that?
I can share with you some of the stories from our family of what we experienced under a system where there was a more central government, mm-hmm. And more control over people, and something that I inherently have a distaste for.
Okay.
I speak out on social media a lot about socialism and kind of our generation's bent and support of socialism, when I think they really have never experienced it or been to a country that's experienced it.
And then just to clarify for listeners, when you say our generation, the generation you're talking about is?
20s, 30s, 40s.
Okay.
younger folks.
You don't want to say the M word.
No, I don't, because I don't think it's fair to label millennial. I mean, I think that term carries such a negative connotation these days.
It does.
And, I've seen some of that, of course, but at Washington Policy Center, we have an initiative called, you know, Young Professionals, which is, you know, an effort of ours to engage young people in public policy and free market ideas. And through that program is actually how I came to know Washington Policy Center.
Oh.
So going back to your question, you know, both of my great grandparents on my dad's side really, really struggled in Russia. On my dad's side, my great grandpa did not recognize or like collective farms, which was a thing in Russia, where everyone had to basically give away their harvest to the state for redistribution. They were not really allowed to own private property. And my great grandpa, he didn't recognize or respect or support collective farms. And so he tried to produce without giving any of his labor away. And so the response to that, of course, was very negative. They took away a portion of his land, which wasn't, I mean, he didn't have very much to begin with, like maybe half an acre. A few times he was beaten severely by locals who were afraid that they would suffer because of his resistance.
Wow.
Then the government came in January one year, which in Russia is a very cold winter, and they cut his home in half. They demolished half of his home. And, you know, and he had a few neighbors shelter him and then go to the forest and find some branches and wood and try to help insulate the house.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
It was a very, very punitive environment for anyone who wanted to practice individual freedom to produce and own the fruits of their labor, literally the fruits of their labor.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
My other great grandpa, he owned a grocery store and a flour mill. And after the revolution, both the grocery store and flour mill were confiscated. And he was labeled a kulak. And kulak means fist in Russia.
Okay.
And it's a negative term. It's a negative label for peasants who can afford a farm and labor. And so he was labeled a kulak. And he was arrested and exiled to a gulag, where he died. And because of kind of our family, you know, because of that experience, his daughter, my grandma, who I loved a lot, she's passed away since, she actually just recently passed away, but she was under police or state supervision for 20 years. And so she and her family had to go to the state once a month and write down what they were doing, what they were thinking, who was visiting them. They would receive sporadic, you know, visits for house inspections from the state. And so that stopped, I mean, that stopped in 1957. That's when she got her rights back. My dad was born 5 years later in 1963. And so, you know, because of those experiences, our family, I guess they were kind of marked. You know, my dad had a really tough time traveling even for tourist purposes. We eventually left the country for personal and religious freedom. There's still no religious freedom in Russia today. I don't know if a lot of people know that, but you must go to the Russian Orthodox Church. There are consequences if you practice a different religion or if you offend somebody. So I'm very grateful that we have left Russia, even though I have such fond memories of it. I know that it's a very harsh central government, and I would not call it a democracy by any stretch of the imagination. And so now my parents live very happy and fruitful lives and have a very different experience. And I have a very different experience because they brought me here.
Sometimes the way that you're speaking about this is I can tell you're being very kind of polite and diplomatic, but certainly I can feel the fire in there. And I think this makes sense on where it's coming from. And I mean, look, I'm wishing you well up there because I do believe that I'm led to believe that if the road usage charge ever comes about, I do think it's going to happen first outside of California. I think our economy here is a little just too big to just implement that without seeing other states toy around with it first. So, again, I see it happening more in Washington first than over here. But especially if you're saying it's still a whiles away, then good. I think there's maybe some comfort on my end. We've talked about so many different things. Your use or you being part of the road usage pilot, your experience, your uncomfortableness, some of the facts on the ground. We've discussed some of the the culture and the society of Washington and how they're implementing smart growth initiatives, and perhaps sometimes where you differ in that respect and your family, and then we also talked about your family history. So I want to give you the last word here of what's next.
I think change takes a really long time, the kind of change that matters and the kind of change that sticks. So we are in a really difficult political climate right now. And I think the work that we're doing at the Policy Center is very valuable. We are advancing free market ideas and ideas that really put people first, right? And make sure that our government is serving the public and not the other way around. And I think there's value to the analysis, the watchdogging, the pressure that we bring to the conversation. We are highlighting issues and documents that would otherwise be unread and not known about by the public by design. And we're highlighting that. We're trying to bring transparency. We're engaging the public, informing the public. We're an educational organization. And really, that's our mission, is to bring to light what is happening in our state and do it in a way that makes sense, right? I mean, there's just so many moving parts, but I think when you put them all together through different mediums, you can really paint a pretty clear picture of the direction that public officials or some public officials are headed. And that's part of my mission, is to bring clarity and transparency to this conversation, to bring greater accountability to public officials, to empower citizens to articulate their positions, to make their voices heard. I think some people have, you know, trouble even talking about some of these things because they are complex. I have trouble talking about them. And so, you know, that's where I hope to be useful, to make sure that there is still an active, vibrant public forum for people who have different viewpoints than what is, you know, trending in our very, very blue state. and making sure that everyone's viewpoints are heard. That's really a I think what I have a heart for. What I really believe in is I really believe in people. I believe that people know what's best. And I really want us to go back to a system where government and we have more public officials who really honor that and who really uplift their citizens rather than taking a more elitist approach and trying to organize our lives for us. That really concerns me. And that's something that we see at a national level too. And I think, you know, you talked about kind of some of the fire that you suspect that I feel, which is accurate. you know, I talked to my
I will stay on your good side.
Well, I talked to my mom and my dad, and, you know, when they see folks talking about socialism in these rosy terms, they're not super engaged on politics. They are engaged in art and medicine, but they come to me and they are like, I cannot believe this is going on. We left this. We came here to, well, how is this happening here? And I think it's really critical that we not leave this debate, that free market thinkers not leave this debate, that we continue to push and push for personal liberty, which I think is far more popular than what we would think based on what we see on social media and also in mainstream media. You know, I think there's a lot more people who agree on both the left and the right that we need to fight for personal liberty, for free speech, for just really honoring the way that the public wants their money to be spent.
Hear, hear. Well, listeners, you can learn more. You can read more about Maria on the Washington Policy Center website. She is very vocal about her opinions, and not just her opinions, but again, bringing her viewpoints and the Washington Policy Center's viewpoints to juxtapose some of the, you know, issues that are surrounding her state when it comes down to transportation. But I mean, obviously you work more on the transportation side, but as a policy center, you guys dabble in all variety of topics there. So listeners, go ahead, check that out. Also listeners, stay tuned for another episode where the Washington Policy Center recently had their solutions summit. So Maria is going to give us just a quick breakdown of what was going on at that event, and specifically the transportation segment at that event. So be sure you tune into the following episode for that. I will put her information on the episode page. Maria, thank you very, very much. And I hope we will do this again. There are certainly a lot of policies that you will be highlighting. I will be following you closely. And hopefully, as we get closer to the November 2020 elections, we can revisit some of these topics to see where things stand.
Thank you so much.
On behalf of Kelly, Rudy, and myself, cheers, prost, l'chaim, kipis, nastravi, salut, kampai, mabru, tutsins, gambe, yamas, nastarovie, to the customer experience.